Good morning and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host, and today is Friday, November 3rd, 2023. Thank you so much for tuning in. We really appreciate you watching the Eastman Financial Report and certainly hope that our programming is beneficial to you. Of course, the goal of this program is to teach critical thinking in the world of economics. And as a result of that, we try hard to analyze the headlines of the day and the headlines of the week and make sense of them from the perspective of the average American person. So thank you for watching us on WVW-TV. It's a privilege for me to be on this network. It's a great network. It's been around since 2006. And we bring to the marketplace of ideas all sorts of viewpoints that usually are not heard on the mainstream media reports. So when you're watching WVW-TV, you're getting some excellent programming, some very stimulating thought, and of course, beneficial not only to the marketplace of ideas that our voices are being heard, but also to you as well as the viewer. As you know, we're not a commercial network. We don't sell advertising, so none of our programming is interrupted by commercials. But we do have sponsors, and we have kind and generous viewers such as yourself who contribute to keep this programming on air. And we thank you very much for that. You notice there's no paywall, and of course, there's no subscription. You can tune in 24/7 and see some really great programming with some really solid ideas and some solid thinking, and it's free. And that's how we contribute to the great marketplace of ideas. We do have sponsors for our programming, and of course, the sponsor for my program is Swiss America Trading, which, as I like to say, is a fine purveyor of precious metals. It's an American company. They're based in Tucson, they're based in Arizona. Excuse me, they're not in Tucson, they're in northern Arizona. And they have been in the market of selling tangible precious metals for a very long time. And they're a very reputable firm and some high quality people that you can do business with. As you can see on the screen here, they offer bullion coins, which are these coins minted by governments. You're looking at the standing liberty halves. And there are effectively three ways to own tangible metals. You can buy bullion coins, which are minted by governments, or you can buy just blocks of bullion, which come in various and sundry sizes and gold or silver content. And then you can also invest in numismatic coins, which are collector coins that have value not only for their gold and silver content, but also for their historic and collector attributes as well. These would be intangible assets that are attributed to the tangible coin. And that's the three basic ways of investing in precious metals. Swiss America is offering a great special right now. They are offering the standing Liberty half dollars in silver, as you can see on the screen, for the low price of about $13.50, which includes shipping. That's a big deal because metal is heavy, and if you buy anything online, you know that shipping things can be rather costly. Well, this is a great deal at $13.50 each, including shipping to your home or business or office, and that's a good price. And that will be it's capped at 250 coins per person, and the deal's over when they run out of inventory. So this will not last forever. When you think about it, it's November 3rd, of course, we're entering into the gift-giving season. We have Thanksgiving and then Christmas and Hanukkah and all the great celebrations in December. Traditionally, Americans give each other gifts, and what a great opportunity to give a gift of precious metals to a loved one. So if you're interested, give Swiss America a call. The number's on the screen, 1-800-519-6271, and ask them to send you some free information or get more information about the silver half dollar special. Also, go to their website, swissamerica.com. If you use the promo code Eastman, which stands for Eastman Financial Report, if you type in Eastman, you can get free information mailed to you if you're interested in learning more about the precious metals sector. And you can take advantage of that $13.50 offer. So I would look at that if you're, you know, scratching your head wondering what to give old Uncle Joe for Christmas this year. Well, I'm sure that he would appreciate tangible precious metals, because not only would Uncle Joe be pleased, but the central banks of the world are also doing the same thing. And I'm going to talk about that in the program today. So anyway, give Swiss America a call or go to their website, swissamerica.com, or 1-800-519-6271. Take advantage of these specials. Okay, let's jump into that. Let's talk about that issue of central banks. I think that is Well, wait, no, we're gonna put that off for just a minute. I want to talk about the headline news this morning, and that is that the United States added only 150,000 new jobs in October. Now, we are a nation of 330 million people. We have a lot of people, millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of people working across the United States in every possible job you can imagine. And one of the big metrics that it's watched by the markets, of course, is the number of new jobs that are created in the economy on a monthly basis. So when you think about adding only 150,000 new jobs to this massive country of ours, 330 million people, that's virtually nothing. And what it tells you is that companies are starting to pull back and they're not creating new jobs. And that means that people who are in the job market are having less choice available. Now, we talked yesterday about the unemployment numbers that came out. And that number had wiggled up a little bit. Remember, every Thursday the unemployment numbers come out, and there are two numbers to watch. There are the new claims, people who are just recently laid off, and you can't collect unemployment if you quit and walk out in a huff. You have to have been laid off for economic reasons, and that's when you can apply for unemployment. Well, we saw a little uptick, and that was 200, and I think it went to 218, if I remember from yesterday. Usually bopping around 210 to 218. Well, that's more than 150,000 jobs created. So what you're basically saying is you get, 218,000 people and there's 150,000 new jobs available. Not that they would match, but statistically, what it's telling you is that the unemployment claims are increasing. The continuing unemployment claim, which is the second number, and that's the one more watched by economists because, applying for unemployment is sort of a discretionary thing. You get laid off 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, all of a sudden the refrigerator's empty. You think, well, I better go file for unemployment. There's a time lag involved. But when you have continuing numbers, and that number approached 1.818 million, if I remember right from yesterday, 1.8 million people that are sitting on unemployment, and there's 1.8 million people on unemployment looking for work, and only 150,000 new jobs were created in October, that's a problem. That's less than a tenth of the people on unemployment, in new jobs. Now, of course, we also know that there's like 9 million jobs that are sitting there open, unfulfilled. So when you start to look at labor numbers, it swirls. There's a lot of swirling going on. But if you're you're a trained plumber and you want to find a new plumber job, and the only jobs available are perhaps in fast food or something, that's not going to be a good match for your economic needs as well as maybe your skill set. So these numbers are always to be taken with a little bit of a grain of salt, but what it tells you is that the unemployment numbers are consistently burdensome, and the new jobs created are virtually nothing in October. There's also a decline in employed workers. If you look at ADP, which is a big payroll processing company, and they put out a metric. And how many people are on the payroll? And then, of course, the states every week or every other week or once a month, however you're paid, the states monitor that because they're withholding taxes that are taken out of everybody's paychecks, and that gets deposited. So there's a pretty good metric of how many people are actually working on any given week. Now, people are always quitting and taking new jobs. There's always this transitional fuzz that's in the middle of the statistics. But at the end of the day, these numbers are fairly accurate from analyzing trends. I mean, you never want to go from 200,000 new unemployment claims to 218 and say that's a crisis. But if you monitor the slope of the line, basically in an academic view, we look at the slope of the line. Is the slope increasing or is it decreasing? Then basically you can get a sense of where the economy's going. And what it's telling us is the employment markets are starting to stall out because the people, and I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that there's the stickiness metric as well. In good times, everybody will, not everybody, but in good times, people who want to advance in their careers will quit their job and take a new job. and they'll take the risk of starting a new job, which, you know, there's always transitional issues and you may not be a good fit and whatever. People are more willing to take that risk if there are jobs aplenty. But when jobs start to tighten, then the stickiness, you hold on to your current situation because you don't want to quit that job and find out that, you know, there's no job for you on the other side. So when we look at these labor things, all of this creates angst and stress within the American consumer, or the American citizen, basically. You know, we all need jobs to pay our bills. And when you realize that companies are broadcasting left and right that the economy is slowing down, you start to become more concerned, because what you don't want to do is lose your job in the middle of a recession, because that puts you in a really dangerous spot. And of course, then you'll be applying for unemployment, but unemployment checks are small and it's just not a good place to be. One of the things I did notice in today's news is that both Walmart and Target, remember, this is earnings season, and basically what companies do is that they'll make public statements about how they foresee the future, the near term, very near term future of their company. And they will make these statements within a defined announcement box. It's usually a dial-in conference call, and they will make public statements about the condition of their company. And those statements are highly regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission, because the whole purpose of a publicly traded company putting out information is very regulated. You have the registration requirements under the 33 Act, and of course, if they trade publicly, which they do, it would be the 1934 Act, the Securities and Exchange Commission Act. The Securities Exchange Act, and all of the communication is regulated. And if you misspeak, that's when the shareholder derivative suits come flying out and the securities fraud suits come flying out. So when the CFO, Chief Financial Officer, and the Chief Executive Officer, CEO, will be on these public calls and make statements, you can rest assured that the lawyers behind them have coached them on what to say, and this stuff must be accurate. You can't go out and say, oh boy, buy our stock because it's going to go to the moon. You know, you can't do that. You have to tell the public very accurately and very non-emotionally what you as management see. How is this ship a sailing? Are the winds fair? Are the winds blowing? Are the waves too high? You have to talk about this stuff accurately. So when you hear public companies coming out and making statements, it's a pretty good chance that the CEO and the CFO, who have personal liability for misstatements of material facts, are telling you what they perceive to be the near-term future or the condition of the business. So when you see Walmart and Target coming out, that consumers are cutting back, that they are dialing back, and they're avoiding the discretionary goods to buy the staples, the food, not fashion clothing, but, you know, a warm coat and boots, that type of thing. Unless you live in the South, I suppose you buy, I don't know what you buy in the South, but in the North, you'd be buying coats and boots. The point is, the consumers are dialing back on the fun stuff and the entertainment-y kind of stuff, because food and gasoline and maybe auto repairs and, of course, health insurance premiums. We don't talk about that much, but health insurance premiums are very cyclical and they're regulated by the states. And when your health insurance kicks in on January 1st, there's always a premium bump. And maybe you're going to be seeing a larger deductible on top of your student loan, on top of your trip to the grocery store, which stunned you. And of course, your stop at the gas station, which did not please you. Then suddenly what Walmart and Target are saying to the public, and this is highly regulated speech for the good of the company and the personal good of the CEO and CFO, when they tell you that the discretionary goods are dropping off and that they're seeing less chance of a robust gift-giving season, that's something to notice, because it dovetails in quite well with the tightening job market, and it dovetails in very well with other metrics that we've been looking at across the spectrum. And of course, this is, you know, Federal Open Market Committee week. And of course, we know that on Tuesday, the Feds decided to keep the interest rates flat. They didn't cut them to stimulate. They didn't push the punch bowl closer to the party. They didn't pull it back. They just left this in the middle of the table, or at least toward the back of the table. So what it's telling us is, notwithstanding all the robust news of the, you know, this amazing economy we live in, indicator after indicator is telling you that there is very significant softness going on. So, you know, other than the political football that goes on with respect to, you know, election season, we want to be analyzing what's going on, you know, in the underlying trends. Now, there's always the allegation, I guess you could say, that, you know, this is always doom and gloom. You know, nobody ever talks about anything good. It's all doom and gloom, and you do this just to scare everybody. Well, you don't. I mean, if you're a careful thinker, you don't want to be thinking emotionally. You want to look at the numbers. Like another report today, bankruptcy filings are up. Well, you know, people don't file bankruptcy in the good times. They file bankruptcy when their revenues don't cover their expenses, their income goes negative, they can't cover their debt service. And this is on the business side. And of course, consumers who are caught with huge medical bills and, you know, the student loans just kicked in, the mortgage. When you see bankruptcies going up, it's not a good sign. I mean, it can be a telltale sign that the bottom is reached and it might be coming around the other way, but we're not there yet. The same thing with the consumer confidence numbers that we saw from the University of Michigan. It's a very well-respected metric that comes out, and what they do, as I mentioned, they sample the person on the street and they say, hey, what do you think about the economy? You know, a lot of people are concerned. I mean, they're not in a panic, and we shouldn't panic, but people have a general sense that, you know, something just ain't right here. And that's starting to manifest itself in these numbers. The same thing with a metric I saw this morning, that the service sector is softening in the U.S. And, you know, in fact, that's kind of an interesting headline. What does that mean? Well, if you think about the American economy as a service-based economy, we have long since transitioned. You know, in the beginning, we were an agricultural economy with seafaring. We would make stuff and ship it back to Europe and England. And then we shifted to an agrarian economy. You know, in the 1900s, you know, it was a big deal. Well, then we went to the manufacturing sector with the Industrial Revolution. Well, now we're in the service sector and everything's digital like we see here. I mean, this is all services. So when we see that the largest sector in the economy is a service sector, healthcare to media to, you know, just general communications at this point, when that's softening, it's not suggesting that we're in some sort of robust times. And I think that's another interesting metric. Another metric that I saw today is the shipping giant, it's a shipping company. It's called Maersk out of Denmark. The Danes have long since been the dominant leader in ocean-going vessels that ship stuff around the world. You know, I guess if you think of the Vikings, you know, sailing to, you know, Newfoundland or Vinland or wherever they sailed off to before the British got here, they're really good at sailing around the world. And that tradition continues today with Maersk. It's a huge company. It is the bell, you know, the bell-ringing bellwether company globally on shipping costs. And of course, their announcement is that they're cutting 10,000 jobs globally. Well, that doesn't affect the United States specifically, and the United States has millions of jobs. But what it tells you is that they are facing a global decline in shipping. And, you know, you see these Maersk containers all over the Midwest on railroad cars that whizzing by when the train goes by, Maersk, and they're on the backs of trucks. And what it's telling you is that these global shipping companies are telling us that they're not shipping as much stuff around the world. And when you think of the United States as being the consumer, you know, hotspot of the world, we consume more stuff than everybody else. What it tells you is that, again, aggregate demand in the economy is declining. And aggregate demand is an interesting economic metric. When I talk about my big ball of the GDP, the gross domestic product, another way of looking at that statistically is aggregate demand. There's the aggregate supply and the aggregate demand, which is coming out of the early Adam Smithian model of a competitive supply and demand equilibrium economy. Well, when aggregate demand shifts, and if it shifts down, there's less quantity demanded, and that means that the price collapses. But when aggregate demand shifts up, people want more of it. ceteris paribus, all other things being equal, if supply is fixed and aggregate demand shifts up, then the prices go up. So what we're seeing is that this decline in aggregate demand for global goods within my GDP ball of the economy is suggesting that we're not necessarily in a good place. And then when you square that with the number that says, well, the GDP ball increased by 4.9%, which is 5%, effectively what it's telling us is, what's telling me is that the a lot of that increase in that number is inflation. It's the same number of units, of goods and services, or fewer, but at a higher price. So of course it looks like the ball is getting bigger when in fact the per unit, the number of units of goods and services sold are shrinking, but the price is higher. And that's not a good place to be, because it's a classic indicator of inflation that is being baked into the system. There's theoretically two kinds of, in economics, it's all theoretical, but your economics professor will tell you there's cost push inflation, and then there's a price pull inflation. And when you see cost push inflation, like the UAW contract that was just negotiated, it's awaiting ratification, those wages are going up, and that's a cost push because it's pushing the costs up, and the manufacturers have no choice but to raise their prices if they want to preserve their margins. Oil is another cost push. And right now, this is a very strange oil market. I debated whether to deal with this today. I think I'll wait till next week, see what happens over the weekend. But oil and energy is always a cost push. When energy prices go up and labor prices go up, it's pushing prices up because prices have to react to those input cost increases to preserve their margins. And I think that's a part of what we're looking at. I think we'll talk more about that next week as well. The big thing, there's one other thing on the strikes issue. I saw a story today that these strikes, in the automobile industry, effectively cost 75,000 jobs across the United States, primarily with the suppliers to the big manufacturers. So when these unions go on strike and they get the higher wage for their workers, there's blowback through the economy. And of course the unions know that. That's part of their strategic planning. And when we strike, it's not just going to be against the big three. We're going to be burning all the little suppliers. And those tend to be family-owned businesses and smaller operations, privately held, and suppliers to big companies. They really take it on the chin. So, quickly losing 75,000 jobs as a result of that action, that has a negative impact. And that basically, when you start looking at, who applies for unemployment, well, if you're working in a supplier manufactory and you lose that job because there's a strike, Ford or GM or Chrysler, they're not buying parts, those are the people who are going to head off to the unemployment line because they've got to preserve a higher level of income, and which it's not going to be done with an unemployment check, but it's better than nothing. So we look at all of these things. And at the end of the day, you get a real sense that you have to be very careful when you're reading the headline that the economy's never been better. We're heading into the election year, the best economy we've had in 100 years. Well, maybe. I guess we also learned this week or last week that government workers' wages went up like 8%. And I think, I suppose if you work for the government, these are probably really good times. If you work anywhere else, maybe not so much. Okay, I wanted to talk about that money gold situation that I alluded to in the beginning when I talked about giving gifts of precious metals to your loved ones or perhaps to yourself. The big story that I've noticed today is that central banks around the world continue to buy gold. Now, this is not necessarily, I'm not trying to talk you into buy gold here, but I want to talk about why the central banks are buying gold. And I think it's important to understand that because the news story talks about record gold purchases by central banks through the second quarter of 2023, which would have ended in June, okay? And in the third quarter, which just ended in September, they're still buying gold. Now, let's break this story down, okay? Now, you're not a central bank, and if you buy gold, you're not buying the tons that they're buying, but let's ask some questions. So let's do some critical thinking here about what does this mean? Well, if we think about it, in the modern monetary era, countries, if you're a country, and you're, you know, a real country, you have a central bank. And I think there's maybe only one or two countries on earth that don't have a central bank, and they're still issuing money from their treasury. But the vast majority of, and all the big players, have a central bank. And that central bank works very much like our Federal Reserve system. And throughout the world, many of these central banks are actually modeled on the Bank of England, which was the central bank long before the Federal Reserve was ever cooked up. So at the end of the day, each country has a central banking organization that is responsible for printing money, creating the money, rather than the treasury creating money, which is the old model. The Federal Reserve and the central banks, that's their job, is to create a money, you know, piles of money so that their gross domestic product, their national income, you know, has got currency to work with. And of course, because we don't have a standard global currency, which is a good thing, in my opinion, every country or many countries have, you know, their own, or like the Eurozone has the Euro. But the point is, the central banks are responsible for printing and issuing the money. And that's how the systems work. And the central banks are also responsible for backstopping the local private banks. If a bank runs into trouble, if there's a run on the bank, think Jimmy Stewart or Mary Poppins, you know, if there's a run on the bank, the central bank's job is to step in and stop the panic. You know, they're shoveling money in the back door while the tellers are shoveling it out the front door, and calm the panic down, and everybody goes home, just like in the Jimmy Stewart movie. It's getting to be that season. Everybody should watch it again and see what the bank panics look like. But the point is, that's their job. And in order to have a central bank with enough reserves to do that, they have to hold a pile of money. You can't just print money. Well, they do. I mean, most places are not just printing money and shoveling it out the door. So what they do is they hold reserves, just like our Federal Reserve and our United States Treasury. They hold reserves in gold. And of course, gold is an archaic metal. And of course, some famous economist, I'm blanking on the name, accused, you know, basically said, well, it's an archaic metal. And, you know, that's interesting, because if anybody has archaic metal they'd like to ship off to WVWTV as a donation, I'm sure that they'd be glad to take it off your hands. But the fact is, it's not, you know, a barbaric relic. Precious metals have a great deal of value in the global marketplace. So why are the central banks increasing their holdings of gold? And it's quite, you know, clear that if this is happening on a global basis, theoretically, the United States has the biggest pile of gold in Fort Knox because we're the biggest, and then the China's a close second, and then the Russians, and then, you know, the little countries have got little holdings here and there, and of course the Swiss, nobody knows how much gold they're holding. But the point is, when you see these central banks that are all increasing their gold holdings, and interestingly, London basically sold off its gold. I don't know what that was all about. I think they will rue the day. But what's happening is, it puts the central banks in a position where if the global reserve currency, the United States dollar, runs into trouble, they will be able to remonetize on a new gold standard based upon the gold holdings in their vaults. And this goes back to very much to the mercantilist period of time, where the kings would have piles of gold. And if you were a king, you wanted a bigger pile of gold than all the other kings, because then all the other kings knew that you would have the ability to pay an army to defend yourself, or you could invade them, see, because you had more money than they do. So gold was a strategic advantage. It was a symbolic advantage of the wealth of a realm. And effectively, that carries forward into modern society. In the event that there's some sort of a, you know, global conflagration of dollars or money, and the world seeks to remonetize, then these places have they have reserves. And if we were to go back to a global gold standard, which would be like Bretton Woods II, where effectively every currency, the dollar was pegged at $35 per ounce of gold, which is a steal, because today it's trading, spot price was $2,002.60 when I looked at it about an hour ago. Effectively, What they're telling you is that they're not quite sure that this global financial system is secure as everyone would like it to be. If they were all very confident, they wouldn't be buying gold. Why would you do that? What it tells you is country after country is positioning themselves in case of some major blowout. So anyway, and that's probably a good reason, you know, you might want to stack up a few, you know, precious metal coins yourself, because if there is a remonetization, that would be a good position to be in. Ask yourself this question, and I'll leave you with this thought. When you look at a 1 ounce US dollar a gold coin, it says $50. Now, the spot price is $2,002. So how can it be $50 versus $2,002? Perhaps it takes $2,002 to buy a $50 new gold coin. Think about that. Have a great weekend. I'll talk more on Monday. Take care. Bye.